Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. On WNYC. So let's talk about New York City becoming the first city in America to impose a cap on the number of Uber cars allowed on the streets and to impose a minimum wage for all kinds of for-hire vehicle drivers. City Council voted on this package of bills that included a one-year moratorium on new licenses for app-based for-hire vehicles. So that's Uber, Lyft, Juno, Via, and the other app cabs, while the city studies how the industry affects congestion and any driver's ability to make a living. Council also set minimum driver pay levels, which we'll also talk about. Now, these measures passed handily yesterday and made waves with headlines not only all over the five boroughs, but all over the world in Paris, Istanbul, Berlin, Amsterdam, Sydney, name your big Uberized city. And so we ask, is the Uber wave beginning to crest? With me now to talk about how the cap might affect drivers, riders, and the city, the minimum wage provision too, is Stephen Essen, transportation reporter for WNYC, who was in council chambers yesterday. Hey, Stephen, always good to have you on.
Good morning, Brian.
And you were there yesterday, which listeners, if you were following it on Twitter, it was like the hottest club in town. The hall was filled with protesters and supporters on the various bills the council was voting on. Set the scene for us. Just tell us what it was like there compared to other things you've covered.
Well, to be fair, the majority, I would say all of the protesters were there for the Inwood vote, and they caused quite a fracas there. They were throwing fake paper money down and shouting at Adonis Rodriguez,
the councilman from Upper Manhattan who came out in support of the mayor's controversial rezoning of the neighborhood to allow for more high-rise buildings.
So that certainly added to the circus-like atmosphere at the council that day. But sure enough, before the vote, certainly members of the Taxi Workers Alliance were out there with signs. They've been fighting in support of this. They want, you know, a crackdown on Uber. They want parity in the industry. They feel like Uber has an unfair advantage in New York. And we've certainly heard a lot about the taxi driver suicides. And they're very much concerned about that and just the future of, you know, driving in New York City as a job, whether it's taxi, Uber, Lyft. They, you know, they make it very clear they want equal pay, equal opportunities for all drivers, regardless of which company they're currently working for.
And as I said, there are two components of the legislation, the cap and the minimum wage. Let's talk about the minimum wage, which in a way is more interesting. $17.22 an hour after expenses, which would increase driver earnings, we are told, by about 22%. On average. How is that number decided on? $17.22 an hour for a minimum wage is certainly not a round number. How'd they come to it?
It's a complex calculation in coordination with the TLC about, you know, how much workers should be making based on the amount of driving they do. One of the big questions I thought is, how exactly are they going to implement this? Councilman Kalman Yeager questioned if the council even has the legal right to set a minimum wage. Isn't that up to the state? And Uber drivers file taxes as self-employed. So legally, how exactly is this going to work? There's still a lot of questions about that, Brian, which are still unanswered. As for the ride-sharing companies, you know, they argue their drivers, if they work a lot of hours and pick up enough fares, pretty much earn that much. Lyft says their drivers on average earn $16 an hour, although they say they're ready to work with the TLC to try to figure out a way to make this work. But essentially, you know, the stated purpose anyways is if a driver is working their full amount of hours and they're still not getting, you know, $17 an hour, the rideshare companies, Uber, Lyft, Via, et cetera, need to bump up their pay to meet that.
And listeners, the more that I see and hear and read and frankly take phone calls from those of you who drive any kind of taxi or Uber, Lyft, Via, et cetera, and we love our cab drivers out there, the more it seems to me that drivers of yellow cabs and drivers from these other services are actually on the same side of a lot of this, because the proliferation of Uber to 100,000 cars, where it was zero not that many years ago, and you know the number of yellow cabs and green cabs is strictly capped, and then add 100,000 to something like, give me the number, Stephen, if you have it. Was it 14,000 yellow cab medallions? Do you know off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. That's pretty close. So, and it's been capped at for a very long time.
Right.
They raised it maybe, you know, less than a decade ago, but not by that much.
Which is not to say that that's the optimal number, or it might not be low, or it might not be a racket. But to go from something like 14,000 to 114,000 before anybody even gets to regulating that number at all, imagine the impact that that has on the average wage. So my sense from what I've been hearing is that Uber and yellow cab drivers and the others are relatively on the same side of this. So we invite your phone calls. Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, Via drivers, Juno drivers, what am I leaving out, as well as yellow and green cab drivers, 212-433-WNYC, particularly on the minimum wage aspect. Do you think this will work for you if, assuming it stands up in court, if it gets challenged in court, as Stephen was kind of implying that it might, 212-433-9692. All right, describe the particulars of the cap.
Right. So, as you know, the Taxi and Limousine Commission issues licenses for all vehicles to drive in New York City. You have to get one to drive, but there's not really too many restrictions. You know, you have to go through some process, but they've been issuing them. The council says they issue 2,000 new licenses every month. So that's a lot of cars on the street. So the council wants to do is not issue any licenses for 1 year so they can study the industry. This is what they say, study the effects on traffic, study where riders are getting on and off of vehicles, and try to get a better sense of what's happening in New York without this fluctuating number of new vehicles on the road. The council says they will make some exceptions. They say handicapped vehicles, which account for less than 1% of vehicles for hire on the road, will be exempt. So if you have a handicapped accessible vehicle, you could still get a license. Although a spokesperson for Lyft I spoke with afterwards says those are actually a lot more expensive than regular cars and they break down more frequently. So they don't think that's fair for drivers. The council also recognizes a lot of the complaints, particularly we heard Reverend Al Sharpton saying that, you know, minorities in different parts of the city, you know, love these apps because for years taxis wouldn't pick them up and wouldn't drive to the outer boroughs. And they're really worried that their drivers are going to be left out in the cold. And that's one of the arguments from Uber and Lyft as well. So the council says if they start to see there's a problem where certain neighborhoods are really having a hard time getting a rideshare, they will amend their cap and maybe allow for some new vehicles in those areas.
So here are a few clips that kind of indicate the Strange Bedfellows coalition against these bills. The vote was not unanimous, but it was very lopsided. It was 39-6 in city council yesterday. But here is Republican council member Eric Ulrich, who represents parts of Queens, on why he voted no.
Unfortunately, the yellow cabs in New York City, it's a very nostalgic thing, but it is a declining industry with an outdated business model. And by placing the cap on new licenses for hire vehicles, that would be the equivalent of the city council deciding that we're going to put a cap on Netflix subscriptions because we're worried about blockbusters that are closing. Technology changes. Society changes. The economy changes. This is a free market, and we have to be able to move with the market.
All right, Republican Council Member Eric Ulrich of Queens, who's probably not your most likely member of city council to show up at a National Action Network rally, and yet he's on the same side as Reverend Al Sharpton.
Ain't no traffic jams. Ain't no traffic jams in Brownsville and yellow cabs. You support Uber, I support us. I'm trying to get to work. I'm trying to get to school. I want somebody to go pick me up.
All right, and that was a little off mic, so if you had trouble understanding it because he was far away from the microphone, "Ain't no traffic jam in Brownsville" of Yellow Cabs was the first line and was the point. So on our show the other week, I put that precise question, citing Reverend Sharpton, to Mayor de Blasio, and he said the Taxi and Limousine Commission will now give more implicit bias training and create a discrimination task force of some sort to address the issue of yellow cab drivers not picking up black and brown customers. He said this:
making very clear to the drivers that discrimination is unacceptable and that the consequences are severe, including literally being unable to do that work anymore, and to educate the public that they can and should report any discrimination immediately, and it will be followed up on aggressively.
So I can hear the head shaking out there of anybody who's been passed up because of what they look like by a yellow cab and thinking, oh yeah, an office in City Hall is going to change that. But did the council bring up this new office yesterday? And as transportation reporter, do you know anything about it?
Right. They threw it out there sort of after Sharpton made his remarks. I should add, there was a bill passed yesterday that would increase the penalty for discriminating against drivers. I don't have the exact percentage or how much more, but the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says it's still short of what the penalty should be to be an effective deterrent and punishment for people who do discriminate against riders.
And before we go to a few phone calls, this morning we should mention this was not just a local story. There were headlines all over the world about the cap, as I mentioned in the introduction, in Istanbul, in Berlin, in Paris.
Australia.
In Australia, it said New York caps ride-sharing licenses, sparking calls for similar action in Australia. Why do you think the move by New York City Council might have such impact?
I mean, Uber is a global company. They're forceful, and they've also been the subject of lawsuits all over the world. I was just reading up on one in Korea. London blocked Uber last year. They recently reinstated their license on a 15-month probationary period. But this is a company that's, you know, disrupted the way the world gets around, quite frankly, and not for the good. A lot of people are citing increased congestion. Like Australia says, Sydney and Melbourne have seen their traffic speeds slow. Congestion's doubled. Sounds a lot like New York. So I think people are looking to ways to restrict the growth without clamping down on, you know, free market capitalism, but while also recognizing that these companies having free rein on the streets, on public streets, you know, is creating a public problem.
Alan in Brooklyn, an Uber driver. You're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Brian. And by the way, I've called in before when I represented myself as an attorney, but I got sick for a couple of years and in the process lost my practice. So Uber drivers come from all avenues and all places. I was at City Hall yesterday, and I was there with IDG, which is the Independent Drivers Guild, which is the union. We weren't unfortunately able to get into the hearing because of we were actually told by security we were going to be able to come in. We weren't because of the fracas that was caused by the folks from Inwood, but we were there. I want to update you about the Reverend Al Sharpton issue, and it shows the level of complexity and how Uber has kind of sifted through, potential supporters from any and everywhere. But one of our representatives, her name is Michelle. She met with Reverend Al just 3 days ago, and she sat down with him. And actually, he did change his position. He was no longer in favor of there being no cap. And that's very significant. It's very significant because, in fact, we all know that there has been a traditional problem and with yellow cab drivers not picking up people of color and not going to areas of color. It has been in the past a very serious problem. But with Uber, when you get into an Uber or a Lyft, you don't know the color of the person that you're picking up. And most people don't know this, but we also don't see the ultimate destination. Somebody could be picking up a lift at West 34th Street and going to Bed-Stuy or East New York. We don't have a clue until we actually press that button that says start ride.
That's good background for people to have. Uber drivers, when they accept a ride on the app in the car, do not know the destination. But they know the pickup point. So are Uber drivers... Alan, stay there for a minute, but Stephen Nesson is our reporter on this. Is there any indication that Uber drivers also are avoiding Brownsville, to use the example that Reverend Sharpton gave, because they know where they're picking people up?
Well, I mean, anecdotally from the Uber drivers I've interviewed, they say, we don't discriminate. We just pick people up and take them where they want to go. And wherever they end up, you know, that'll lead to their next fare, will lead to their next fare. And Uber, the company, says, you know, most of their rides do at least originate in the outer boroughs. They may very well end up in Manhattan, though.
So, Alan, arguing...
I can explain how... That's a very significant point, because we are essentially trying to pick up our next ride as close into proximity as to where our last ride left off. So when we get a request, the request will give the name indicated, and actually the name indicated in the app doesn't actually have to be it's not necessarily the real name of the person. Right. It could be AJ or it could be D, and that may not be the person's name.
Alan, let me jump in, because I mean, I hear the case that you're making effectively, and that I think most people accept for why Uber is better in this respect. But does that mean you oppose the cap? Because you, as a driver, might stand to do better with the cap, because there'll be less competition on the road, because they won't be able to add more cars for the next year.
Oh, absolutely. I'm in favor of the cap. The cap, the slowness of traffic really hurts Uber drivers. I've been in situations in Midtown where, for example, I get a request. And by the way, when we get a request, it also says what the algorithm will tell us how long it takes to get to the request. I could get a request that says, John, 1 minute, meaning it should, as the algorithm reads it, I should be able to get to John in 1 minute. It could say, Sarah, 10 minutes. Now, that's also an important issue, because we don't get paid for the time that we have to travel to get to the location. Right. So if it so happens somebody's in an area that may be, quote, underserved, then we might not take the ride that says 10 minutes. But here, there's a lot of opportunities for, if Uber and Lyft actually wanted to solve these problems, that they could. Now, number one, they could actually pay us either a full or even an incentive pay. Maybe if it were 25% of a regular ride to be paid for the time from that we start going toward the request until the time we get to the request. Mm-hmm. I can get a request and it says 10 minutes to get to John, mm-hmm. and 8 minutes into the time that I'm on my way, John cancels the request.
Alan, I'm going to leave it there so I can get some voices on, but I thank you for your contribution. And Stephen Nesson, that's an interesting proposal. I haven't heard it before. I don't know if it's actively in the conversation in the circles of power, but Uber giving Uber drivers a financial bump for going to basically an underserved area, meaning a place where there's no other Uber driver within a 10-minute drive, for example.
Right, and the council does want to study maybe how to more effectively put cabs in places that need people and get them out of places where maybe they're overcrowded, like Midtown Manhattan. One of the numbers that the advocates, proponents of this bill were throwing around is that 40% of the time, drivers are just driving around looking for a fare. Some people dispute that number and say it's inaccurate, but that's what some studies have found.
Can you confirm or refute his claim from the beginning of the call that Reverend Sharpton's position on this has evolved and he's not necessarily against the cap at this point? You have any I haven't seen any indication of that in the press that I've seen.
I haven't seen any indication.
Thank you for your call, Alan. And Phil in Suffolk County, another Uber driver. You're on WNYC. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Brian. How are you? Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I just want to qualify a couple of things before I say what I'm going to say. I've got a very high customer service rating with Uber and Lyft. And I have an extremely high acceptance rate, because if you want to really make money well with these apps, the thing to do is let the app run you. Go to where the app says pick up, pick the people up, make great conversation, take them to where they want to be, pick up your next person. I make after expenses around about $25 an hour, and I do not work more than 40 hours a week. And there's a reason I don't work more than 40 hours a week, which is health and safety. When you're driving, when you're talking, with all of the things coming at you around Manhattan, around the five boroughs, it's quite a draining job. Now, this is my point, and this is what really concerns me. Drivers can have customers in their car for up to 10 hours a day. If you're going to start mandating some sort of minimum wage, which is a very traditional way of looking at things, you will get drivers trying to drive more and more hours than they are even now to achieve minimums if they're not getting them.
That's an interesting point. And Phil, I'm going to leave it there for time. So Phil Stephen is arguing that he, as an Uber driver, if he really does it smartly, which he says is following the app, so you're always as close as you can be to your next fare because the app is going to tell you where the next closest ride is, he is making more than the minimum wage, just driving 40 hours a week. With the new minimum wage that the city council is trying to impose, it would create more money, therefore more incentive to drive too many hours and put both driver and passenger safety at risk. I don't know. But is there any regulation on the number of hours? Do you know?
I'm not aware. I've definitely spoken with drivers that do excess of 60, 70 hours a week sometimes. Many drivers I spoke with say in the last year, particularly, they've been driving more hours for like less pay, or more hours basically just to make what they were making at 40 hours. It's very much up to the driver. A lot of drivers, you know, they're still doing this as a gig economy, a part-time thing, as a way to make ends meet while they're in school or on summer vacation.
Although the very interesting Ginny Belafonte column in the Times today says Uber's line was that this is gig economy, you can do this part-time while you're going to school, while you're, you know, doing your other things part-time, and it can be part of a good living in that respect. But really, the rates are so low that what you find is a really large percentage of Uber drivers are winding up doing it full-time.
Right.
So, interesting pushback. And I don't know, to Phil's point, if you can make a good hourly rate because there's a minimum wage, or because you're strategic like him, if you're making a good wage, a decent wage, that's the same incentive to drive more or to not drive more. Barbara in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you
for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an African-American and a senior citizen, and yellow cabs still don't pick up African-Americans, and they don't drive in African-American neighborhoods or in the outer boroughs, and barely the green cabs. And so I don't understand why Uber has gotten to be such a problem when there are so many other gypsy cabs and small cab companies running around in the outer boroughs that nobody pays attention to. But Uber has gotten to be very successful. And I think a lot of people feel a lot safer with Uber than the other little small gypsy cabs, even though they cost a fortune. I just think I'm so glad that they're around.
Do you, in your experience, if you're using Ubers, do you think that there is still a shortage of available cars for you to use when you need one, that with 100,000 Uber cars that are on the road just in the last few years, on top of the yellows and the greens and the gypsies and the black cars, that there needs to be more? Because that's the issue with the cap.
Do I think there needs to be more?
Even more.
I would support it. You know, I live in Woodside. I can't get a yellow cab to take me into Manhattan.
Can you get an Uber, or is it difficult?
Yes.
Yes. Barbara, thank you very much. So some people will use that as the argument to say, okay, you know, they did it. Barbara and people in Brownsville, who Reverend Chopton was referring to, and a lot of other people, the Ubers are there. It's enough.
I mean, certainly interviews with people around the city find everyone says they don't really have a problem getting an Uber, even if they had to wait one or two more minutes. It's not an issue. And the companies say, you know, across all the apps, there's a 25% attrition rate for drivers every year. Again, it's a number that's hard to fact check right now, but I guess the study will perhaps show whether that's true or not. But they say with that attrition rate, you know, they need more drivers to be licensed because they come and go so frequently.
WNYC transportation reporter Stephen Nesson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and some of you have gone through this, living for years, decades even, in a place that is suspended in time. Your access to information about the outside world is extremely limited, as is your access to your loved ones. Your schedule is strictly regimented, and your every movement is closely monitored and controlled. This, of course, is the life of an incarcerated person. Now imagine years later, you're released back into society, but with little or no support. You go from being forced to walk in a straight line every day to being dropped off in the middle of Grand Central Terminal during peak rush hour. You must navigate changes in technology, changes in your community, your family. You have to find a job, a place to live, and figure out how to live in a free society once again, all at once. Joining us now is Bruce Western, professor of sociology and co-director of Columbia University's Justice Lab, who is one of the principal investigators of the Boston Reentry Study, which followed 122 newly released prisoners for a year in their reentry back into society. He writes about it in his new book, Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. Professor, thank you so much for coming. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
By way of context, you say we need to start this conversation in the context of mass incarceration. And I was a little surprised to hear you say that off the air, because you're telling people's personal stories, their individual stories of reentry, and yet the context is mass incarceration. How come?
Well, we're in a really historically unusual time right now. For most of the 20th century, the incarceration rate in the United States was about 100 per 100,000. That means that 0.1% of the population were locked up behind bars on any given day. But right now, the incarceration rate is about 7 times higher for African American men born since the late 1970s. If they dropped out of high school, 2/3 of them are going to spend time in prison at some point in their lives. So the whole problem of coming out of prison, finding your place in a community after incarceration, this isn't experienced just at an individual level, but it's a wholesale problem for disadvantaged communities, and that's quite new.
And set the stage for our listeners. What's the Boston Reentry Study?
The Boston Reentry Study was an interview study I conducted with a research team at Harvard University, and we followed people coming out of prison for a year, 120 people, and we interviewed them 5 times in a year. The first time we interviewed them was a week before they got out of prison. So we went into prisons all over Massachusetts. And the only thing you had to be eligible for the study was that you were returning to a neighborhood in Boston. Then 2 weeks later, we interviewed you again. And there was kind of this miracle. After we talked to you in prison, you reappeared in the community. We interviewed you then. And then 4 times again over the remainder of the year. We talked to people a lot about their housing, their family relationships, their employment, their health, and also their involvement in crime in the criminal justice system.
And you mentioned that most of the subjects in your study are provided social services such as Medicaid and food stamps. Why is that not enough?
We observed enormously high level of material hardship, a very high level of poverty after release from incarceration. And Massachusetts, in many ways, is a best case scenario. Nearly all the people we talked to were enrolled in Medicaid, sometimes before they were released from prison. That's not widely available throughout the country. 80% of our sample were enrolled in food stamps at some point. And that's not widely available to formerly incarcerated people throughout the country. And yet, despite all of that government support, the rate of poverty was very high. The average income in the year after incarceration was about $6,000, which poverty researchers call a level of deep poverty.
And you write that incarceration is intended as justice through punishment, but perversely has the inverse effect. What do you mean?
It really adds to the disadvantage of people and of communities that have often suffered very great harm themselves. And so I think one of the surprising things for us in this research was the long histories of involvement in violence in different ways of the people we're talking to. And it often began early in childhood in the family home, and people had suffered great victimization themselves. They'd been witnesses to violence over a lifetime. So the system is winding up heaping punishment on people who themselves had suffered very great harm.
Listeners, our lines are open with Bruce Western, who's the author of Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. And first priority right now on the phones will go to anyone who's been incarcerated. We would love to hear your experience reintegrating back into society. Did you have enough support? How did you manage restarting your life? Or if you have a close family member or other person who you've seen be released from prison and reintegrate either more successfully or less, we would like to hear about it and what you think the moral of your story or their story is. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So just to be very practical, and we can go into other aspects of your book as we go, but just to be very practical, with the kinds of backgrounds that you're talking about people who wind up in prison in the first place, and Medicaid and food stamps, those basic supports, not being enough, what are the first things you would have government do?
I think there are three real priorities that we saw in just talking to people immediately after they came out of prison. Housing is just fundamentally important. We saw no independent housing in our sample in the year after prison. So people were doubling up with family, or they were in shelters or transitional housing, or they were street homeless. Healthcare is the second priority area. People were in poor health. They were in very poor mental health, high rates of depression, PTSD, and there was some serious mental illness. And people are in poor physical health as well. And so that continuity of care from the institution to the community is fundamentally important. And the third thing is employment. People really struggled to find work, and we saw about 50% unemployment over the entire year.
And so what about getting more people into employment? There's a ban the box movement, which has been successful some places, so employers can't routinely ask if you've been incarcerated. What else?
I think, and Massachusetts is a strong ban the box state. I think we need to incentivize employers much more intentionally, much more robustly, to take on people who have been incarcerated. And a second real important need here is skilled work. The people who did really well after incarceration, we had a small group in the sample, white men who tended to be a little bit older, and they had connections to union jobs in the construction industry. And they were really the only group who were consistently above poverty. And I think if we can build those bridges to skilled jobs in particular, and if we can incentivize employers, I think, you know, that is an employment program after incarceration that could make a real difference.
And there's a mindset here. You were talking to me about this off the air before we went on as well, and you write in the book that most policymakers view recidivism as the problem and as a behavioral problem. And you think if policymakers focus less on recidivism, even though obviously you don't want people committing more crimes and, you know, behaving badly in ways that are going to land them in prison again for the sake of potential future victims, if we looked at it more as a issue of reintegration than recidivism, it might actually be more successful. Why do you make that distinction?
Yeah. I appreciate you asking about that. I think recidivism is very tricky, and it's very tricky on at least two counts. One is that in part, it is system produced. So one of the things that we found was that people under parole and probation supervision were at increased risk of returning to custody. And in a lot of cases, that was for technical violations of the conditions of their supervision. So they weren't conducting crime again, but they were violating their conditions, and often because they were failing drug tests. The second thing is that drug relapse was our strongest predictor of return to custody. And that was about failing drug tests and in some cases engaging in crime to support a drug habit. And in some cases, because of the antisocial behavior that followed from drug use. And to me, drug relapse is fundamentally a health problem, and we can deal with it more effectively with health interventions rather than criminal justice interventions.
My guest is Bruce Western from Columbia University, where he's co-director of the Justice Lab there. And he was one of the principal investigators of the Boston Reentry Study, which followed 122 newly released prisoners for a year in their reentry back into society, and has a new book about that called Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. And Kwame in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Doing all right. Thanks for calling.
I'm calling because I think the key to success in terms of reentry is it's all about gainful employment. And even before gainful employment, I think it's preparing inmates or prisoners or whatever you want to call them, preparing them to get employment. And I think that the prison system, as currently constituted today, do not do a good job, and in fact do a horrible job with preparing these men and women to return back to society.
Kwame, thank you very much. Is there anything in your experience, if you feel disposed to disclose, that worked or didn't work along those lines?
I mean, for me, I was focused from day one when I went in that place to change the way that I was going to do things coming out, because I didn't want to go back and forth, and I had a great support system, mainly my mother and my brother. You know, I came home to a decent home and, you know, decent people that were just, you know, behind me. But a lot of men and women do not have that support system. They go into, you know, they go into shelters. It's probably even worse than, the prison system. And, you know, I mean, everybody's situation is different. My situation was great, you know, considering. So far as me personally, it started with me and my way of thinking and me being focused on what I wanted to do. But, you know, my family played a huge part into where I am today.
Kwame, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Darren in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Darren.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, so I spent 2 decades in New York State prison system. And when I was returned back to society, I was returned to South Carolina. And even with a college education, you know, there was a lot of barriers, you know, in regards to employment. You know, we have our, you know, country has over 48,000 laws or statutes that restricting and obstruct, you know, the lives of people returning back to their homes, especially for those who have a criminal conviction. Like one case scenario is in California, where you have women who are incarcerated fighting firefighters for less than $1 a day, but these same women, when they return to society, they can't get a job as a firefighter because of their criminal conviction. Mm-hmm. So I think, organizations that's working around, a working future for people who have criminal convictions, is very important that, you know, we keep that in mind and really dismantle a lot of the laws, these 19th century laws, you know, for people to have a working future in the 21st century.
Darren, thank you so much. So, Bruce, our first two callers, jobs and jobs.
Jobs and jobs. And I think that's right. I mean, the people who did best among those that we're interviewing, employment was fundamental. As Kwame mentioned, family support too was instrumental to finding stable employment. And I want to touch on one other thing as well as part of this. We also found that older women in the communities in which we were doing our interviewing were doing so much work in supporting people coming out of incarceration. And I think when we talk about family support, we don't often think about the roles that are being played by mothers and grandmothers and older sisters. But so much of the caring work and the financial support, the material support, the housing after incarceration falls on those older women. And I think as a matter of public policy, we should be thinking about how can we support those older women as well.
And when we come back from a break, I want to ask you about your chapter on women in particular in this regard. And we'll also take more of your phone calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Bruce Western from Columbia University, who was one of the principal investigators of the Boston Reentry Study, which followed 122 newly released prisoners for a year in their reentry back into society. And that's the subject of his new book, Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. Before we go back to the phones, a whole chapter of the book is devoted to women, and you contend that women's incarceration, more than men's, highlights the role of prison as a social policy agent of last resort. What do you mean by that?
The women we spoke to in the study were really struggling with a whole variety of problems that were quite qualitatively different from what we saw among the men. They had long and very serious histories of victimization. They really struggled with mental health problems and physical problems at a level that we didn't see among the men. And their pathway into prison was often a product of their histories of victimization and trauma, their struggles with drug addiction and mental illness. There was a gaping public health crisis among the incarcerated women that that we were interviewing. And to my mind, my thinking about this really evolved in the course of the study. The prison is an institution designed for punishment. That's fundamentally what it's about. And yet the women who find their way into prison are struggling very, very deeply with their biographies and their health. And the prison is trying to manage these problems in some way, but it's woefully inequipped to do so.
Jonathan in East Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I kind of just feel like when I got locked up when I was younger for a nonviolent offense, and they gave me an opportunity to go to a drug rehab, and I took full advantage of it. I got my GED, I got my license, I got a trade, and I haven't looked back since and been a productive part of society. So I just feel like maybe if there was more opportunities like that instead of just sentence, because if I would have went to jail, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now. So I just feel like if there was more opportunities like that, where they just get you prepared for something. Even like a trade is huge. So when you come out, maybe you can find something in that field. And, you know, that's how I feel.
Jonathan, thank you so much. Please call us again. So again on jobs, but also on drugs.
Yeah. So there was a huge number of drug problems in among the people that we were talking to. And drug treatment was fundamentally important. But another piece is that for people who are struggling with addiction, relapse is a very, very predictable outcome of that struggle. And the criminal justice system is not equipped to be forgiving in the way that the treatment of addiction requires. And again, you know, at its core, the criminal justice system is a blaming institution. And particularly in cases where people are really struggling with addiction, their health problems are poorly matched to what the justice system provides.
But I think the other thing that Jonathan was getting at was alternatives to incarceration.
Yeah, absolutely. I think and so there's a fundamentally different approach available. Once we take full account of the social context in which people are finding their way into the justice system, there isn't adequate treatment, there aren't adequate economic opportunities, and you can imagine an alternative system that develops both of those areas and moves decisively away from punishment.
Ife in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ife.
Hello, first time caller. Welcome to your guest. I also am an alumnus from Columbia University, Teachers College, actually. Mm-hmm. My question has to do, I would like to return to something you spoke about, probation. And how it may be systematically designed to support recidivism.
And you've been a psychologist with the court system, is that right?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and yes, I worked as a consultant, often called in to do testing, psychological testing, mm-hmm. particularly of youth. Rikers, this and that.
So the parole system, and forgive me because we're going to run out of time shortly, but the parole system as building the likelihood of recidivism as opposed to against it, how do you see it, Ife?
Well, it's designed, even with youths who have a nonviolent, they go into the probate, they're caught, they go to Rikers, I test them, blah, blah, blah. But then they are on probation and it's guaranteed pretty much that they're going to do something else, jump a turnstile, whatever, which will violate their probation, and then all the charges that had been, and then they go to jail.
Briefly, how can that change? How should that change, in your opinion?
I believe that your guest said the prison system is designed for punishment. I think it's also designed for profit.
Ife, I'm going to leave it there for time. Thank you very much. Well, we've been talking about, you know, returning to society. What about the role of the parole system?
I mean, I think the parole system can be a recidivism trap. And the problem is when people come out, they're released subject to a large, large number of conditions, many of which are very difficult to comply with. Don't consort with people with prior records. Stay away from certain neighborhoods. Do programming and find employment under conditions in which it's very difficult to find employment. The parole officers don't have the tools to help.
So informative, so interesting. We really appreciate everybody who called and shared their stories. And we really appreciate Columbia University Professor Bruce Western, who's a professor of sociology and co-directs the Justice Lab there, and is now the author of Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So there's a movie out in theaters now that's getting a particular amount of buzz. It's called Eighth Grade. It follows 13-year-old Kayla Day. Maybe you've seen the movie already. Kayla Day, played by Elsie Fisher, as she navigates her final week of middle school. Her anxieties, aspirations, and awkward attempts to befriend the popular kids at her school are set amid her and her peers' habitual use of social media platforms like Snapchat, Instagram, and YouTube. The movie also explores the relationship between Kayla and her dad, played by Josh Hamilton, which at various points is loving, but also awkward and a bit strained. Here's a clip. Kayla speaks first, then her dad.
Can you not look like that, please?
What? Like what?
Just like the way you're looking.
Looking at the road?
You can look at the road, Dad. I obviously didn't mean that. Just like, don't be weird and quiet while you do it.
Sorry. Hey, how was the shadow
thing? No, you were being quiet, which is fine. Just like, don't be weird and quiet. Because like, I look over at you and I think you're about to drive us into a tree or something. And then I get really freaked out and then I can't text my friends. So just like, be quiet and drive. And don't look weird and sad. Please.
Okay.
That's worse.
Parents, does that sound familiar? Eighth Grade was written and directed by Bo Burnham. Now 27, he's made a career as an actor and comedian who first rose to fame posting his own videos on YouTube while he was still in high school. Bo, thanks for coming in. Congratulations on the film. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Why'd you make this film?
I don't know. You know, I really set out not to make a story about young people. I just wanted to make a story about how I was feeling at the time that I was writing it. I was feeling very anxious. I wanted to talk about anxiety. I wanted to talk about the internet because I felt like my anxiety was sort of interfacing with the internet in a sort of in a strange way. And yeah, the more research I did, the more I dug into people expressing themselves on the internet, the more I realized that I think I was sort of feeling like an eighth grader. And also, you know, if you want to talk about what's going on right now, it feels like the country's sort of having an eighth grade moment. It feels like things are changing very rapidly and we're sweating and we don't know what's going on.
Do you mean having to do with social media and Russia or more
yeah.
than that?
Yeah. Well, I mean that, yeah, it feels like the political landscape is maybe functioning at an eighth grade level at best. And yeah, I don't know. But it was just that I wanted to have a conversation about the internet in a film that was subtler than Russia and cyberbullying. We seem to only tend to talk about the internet in terms of big sweeping social trends and not just sort of the way it interfaces with the heart and with your tummy and with kids. That's what they're, it's a subjective feeling is what kids are interfacing with the internet. They're not doing, you know, it isn't playing out a million kids at a time. It's playing out individually.
One life, one online relationship at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
So listeners, anybody listening right now who has seen Eighth Grade, what'd you think? What issues did it raise for you? What questions do you have for writer-director Bo Burnham? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How much did it hit home to your own experience in middle school, or maybe you're a parent, and it hit home on that level? Did it reveal anything that you found mystifying about your own current or recent middle schooler's experience in life? Oh, if I'd only seen that movie 3 years ago when my kid was in eighth grade, anything like that? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Go more into what you just started to say, because the film, for those who haven't seen it, really tries to interrogate the ways that social media dominates many kids' lives. Nearly every interaction is mediated, as it were, by social media in the film. What are you trying to tell us about the role that these platforms play?
You know, I'm really not trying to tell anything more than I'm just trying to honestly depict it, I think. There's so much commentary about kids on the internet, too much for me. And, you know, the only people that actually know the internet that are within it don't have any context to comment on it. And the people that are sort of helicoptering over it, talking about it, for me, have no authority to speak about it because they actually have no personal experience with it. So my impulse is, you know, 20 years down the line, when these 13-year-olds become social scientists, I'll be very curious to hear what they have to say about the internet. But until then, for me, it's just like, we need to sort of take emotional inventory of what's going on. So this is just hopefully a subjective experience of the way it feels, which it isn't just bad. If the internet was just bad, it'd be so much easier to address. You know, throw your phone into the ocean. But the problem is it's making kids more connected and more lonely. It's stimulating them and numbing them. They can express themselves or objectify themselves. So for me, I'm pretty unresolved and ambivalent about it, but I know the way it makes me feel, and that's sort of what we're going for, just the feeling.
And to talk a little bit more about your main character, Kayla is very shy and generally not very talkative with her peers. At one end of middle school ceremony, it's announced that she was voted most quiet in her class. And there's another scene where she goes to a pool party where she doesn't really know anyone and she has a panic attack. Was this kind of social anxiety either something that you experienced at that age or something that you thought was important to depict at this time?
It really was something that I was experiencing as I was writing it. You know, I wasn't a necessarily anxious eighth grade boy, but as a 24-year-old when I was writing this, I was having panic attacks doing stand-up. I was, you know, previously a stand-up comedian, and I was having a panic attack backstage at town hall instead of, you know, in a bathroom before a pool party, but the feelings are the same. And as I express my anxieties on stage, I would have young kids, girls in particular, come up to me and say, "I feel the same way you do." I had thought my anxieties were so grounded in my particular experience, which was I was a comedian with an audience performing. And then I realized that my sort of stresses as a D-list celebrity had been democratized and given to an entire generation. Now, everyone feels like they're their own publicist with their own brand and they need to present themselves. So it's strange. It's the thought that sort of performance anxiety, public speaking, has now, that anxiety has dripped into sort of every one of our interactions. Every interaction feels like some stage. I mean, you know, Shakespeare, all the world's a stage. He was onto it a little earlier than I was. But yeah, it feels, it's a strange form of performance, I think, being alive right now.
My guest is Bo Burnham, writer-director of the new movie Eighth Grade, and Kevin in Astoria. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Bo Burnham. I've been listening to you since you were on YouTube. I just wanted to say thank you. I'm a middle school teacher myself, dealing with my own boatloads of anxiety. And after seeing this film, I want to connect with my, it made me want to connect with my students in a different way, because I think we are both going through a lot of the same things, but never really acknowledge it. And we write it off as like a kid thing or adults are so crazy. And I feel like this is a beautiful bridge and puts in a lot of what I've been trying to say into words.
Well, appreciate it, man. Well, that's really nice. And you're doing God's work, you know, and really I feel, you know, hopefully the movie says, like, the movie is not saying that, you know, parents or teachers, the kids, the people that are close to the kids, I don't think are failing them at all. It's really the larger culture that seems to be failing them. It's the, you know, boardroom in Silicon Valley 3,000 miles away making decisions about their neurochemistry that's failing them. But you made a really great point, and I think it's true, is that, you know, part of what kids are struggling with is because they're young and they're going through puberty and all that stuff's changing. But also part of what they're struggling with is just the human condition. You know, some of the questions that they're asking themselves and the problems they're facing are problems they're going to face for the rest of their life. And yeah, I wasn't writing and working with the kids that I realized I could, yeah, have much more eye-level conversations than I thought I could. But I didn't have the burden of also having to teach them grammar or whatever you're teaching them. Like, so, you know, God bless you, and I wish you luck with it.
Kevin, thanks for calling in. And here's another clip. Kayla records and uploads her own videos, which are kind of like motivational speeches, and deal in an indirect way with things she's thinking about and feeling. Let's listen to about 25 seconds of one of those.
Hey guys, Kayla back here with another video. Okay, so the topic of today's video is putting yourself out there. Okay, so like, what does that mean? Where is there? Well, there can be anywhere that you wouldn't usually go, you know, maybe because it's like weird or scary or something like that.
Jenna in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jenna.
Hi. Hi, Brian. Hi, Bo. I saw the movie last weekend, and I was really blown away by it. It was so accurate. I'm only 23, but I feel like I was in the eighth grade yesterday. it's crazy to me how accurate it was. And I was wondering specifically about the scene where Kayla is in the car with the older boy. that pressure was so real, and I'm just shocked at how accurate it was and how you were able to write that in a way that would come off meaning so much to so many people. I'm just curious about that scene.
Oh, really appreciate it, Jenna. Thank you. You know, I'm sort of most close to the women around me. I have, you know, my mother, my sister, also my girlfriend of 6 years is a writer director, and she's the only person that's reading my stuff as it's being written. So if I'm ever way, way off base, you know, I trust her to be able to tell me that I'm, you know, whether I'm making a mistake or not. But yeah, part of that scene, which, you know, I won't be too explicit with for people that haven't seen the movie, but yeah, part of that scene was also me feeling like I needed to interrogate young male behavior and what I was familiar with. I never was doing what that boy was doing in that scene, but I was a young boy and around young men, and I think hopefully what's happening in the culture right now is sort of forcing us men to sort of reinterrogate what that time meant to us, how we may have wielded power in a situation where we felt unsure of ourselves and weren't really taking inventory of what the other person was feeling. But so much of the story beyond that scene, but included in that scene, is just collaborative and listening and trying to be honest. And it being a young girl's story, I was very aware that I was a man the whole time. So I was just trying to subjugate myself to whatever her truth was and just listen. So my job was to just listen and be sensitive and communicative with the actors and, you know, adjust accordingly as people informed it. But a film is a very big group effort. So if it feels true, it's not just me that's contributing to that.
Jenna, thank you so much. Holly in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're on WNYC with Bo Burnham. Hi, Holly.
Oh, I'm so excited to be on. Thank you, Brian. I am a New York expat. I just wanted to say that I went to the movie with my middle schooler, and we both really enjoyed it. It made both of us laugh. And just going on with the last caller mentioned was that scene was a really powerful one, and I think it really gave me an opportunity to address that subject with my daughter. She's only 12, and yeah. So... it was a great movie. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah, I mean, for me, the something that informs that scene it's a scene where she's sexually pressured by an older boy, and one of the problems for me about, you know, sex education, at least when I was in eighth grade, I think this conversation is changing quickly, but, you know, kids learn a lot about anatomy, they learn a lot about, you know, contraceptives, and they learn absolutely nothing about how to actually navigate real interactions between a person. You know, anatomy means nothing if you act. That's step 12. And step 1 through 11 is what should be said, what needs to be said out loud, what needs to be agreed to. And I think those things are changing the classroom, hopefully. But yeah, hopefully the movie can be sort of enough of a safe distance to be able to have the conversation in the abstract. But that means so much. Thank you so much.
Holly, I'm curious what the conversation was like between you and your daughter after the film. Was it awkward seeing this, you know, together with her because of what's depicted and the issues that it raised, or did it open you up to each other in any new kind of way?
Well, I didn't get to have a conversation yet because then she was whisked off to a sleepaway camp. But, I can say that it was very awkward for me being with her in that, and I was a little bit scared as to what was going to happen. But it is going to be a stepping stone for us to be able to talk when she comes back.
Thank you very much. I think John in Nyack might have had a similar experience. John, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Brian. Hi, Bo. My two daughters were in the film as extras.
I was going to say, and we filmed in Upper Nyack.
I filmed it there. And I appreciate the experience. I had a great time filming the movie. I took my two daughters and another girl who was in the film to see it at Jacob Burns last week. And while they enjoyed the movie, they found it really difficult to watch, particularly my daughter who has an anxiety disorder. And I think it speaks to how authentic the depiction of anxiety is in the film. And it was moving for us. It was moving for me as a father too, and also difficult for me to watch as a father. We made sure we knew the content of the film in advance, so we made sure that we weren't sitting with our kids during the movie.
Right. Well, I really appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, you know, eighth grade is tough to go through. You know, anxiety is tough to deal with. You know, and it was important for us to try to make a film that wasn't necessarily just aspirational, because a lot of things for kids are aspirational, and that's good, but it feels like it's, you know, important to also show what it feels like. And yeah, for kids that are within that experience, it feels like, oh, in my free time of being a stressed out eighth grader, I have to go watch a stressed out eighth grader. But hopefully, you know, with a little distance, they feel less alone. in their feelings.
It's also important for parents. It's important for me as a parent of a middle schooler to remember what it felt like. And it's easy to forget because you want to forget what it was like to be in eighth grade.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it was meaningful for me, too, just to remember so I could identify with the experiences my daughters are going through.
Well, that's wonderful. Perfect. And I'm so glad your daughters were a part of the film. Thank you. I appreciate it.
John, thank you very much. A few people are calling in to follow up on Jennifer Manhattan's question about you as an adult male writing a lead character who's a teenage girl.
Yeah.
Did you get any pushback or have any internal dissonance about sort of appropriation or authenticity writing a story that on any level you shouldn't have had permission to write?
Sure. I mean, all that dissonance was internal first. I mean, I certainly understood what was happening as I was thinking of these ideas. I mean, you know, I was aware that I was a man in charge of a young girl's story. The truth is, I watch, you know, hundreds of videos of kids online talking about themselves. The boys talked about video games. The girls talked about their souls. I resonated way more with them than I did the boys. Also, after my stand-up shows, it was 13-year-old girls that would come up to me and understand what I was talking about more than even men my own age. So if there was a bridge that I had to walk to write the movie, it was built to me from them first. For me, I connect most viscerally to pieces of art that I don't demographically align with. I mean, if I can see myself in someone else that isn't on the surface me, that is important. And I hope it serves the particular experience of a girl and the female condition of being young. But I also hope anyone can see themselves in this girl.
Bo Burnham, writer and director of the new film, Eighth Grade, out in theaters now. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.